everyone, and welcome to RadChat, the multi-award-winning first therapeutic radiographer-led oncology podcast. Welcome to podcast number
127.
My name is Jane McNamara, and I'm joined by fellow host Namjoel Anderson.
Hi, everyone.
So a big thank you to our last guest, Ellie Crawley, who talked about sustainable fitness, Feel Fit, that she started to help people live better and longer. If you haven't had a chance yet, please do go and take a listen. So I'm really pleased to introduce our guest, Louise Codd, who's going to be discussing her doctorate research looking at the experiences of ethnically diverse students in therapeutic radiography undergraduate education in the UK. Welcome, Louise.
Hello, thank you both so much for having me. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to come and talk with you.
Oh no, the pleasure is absolutely all ours. As soon as we saw your doctorate research on social media, we were like, oh, we have to get Louise on. And absolutely, you know, we're excited for this conversation. So thank you for joining us. So for Louise, anyone out there who doesn't know you, doesn't know what you do, can you just fill us in, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, I'm a qualified therapeutic radiographer. I'm still working clinically at the moment, and I combine that with a job as a senior lecturer in university as well. So I've been qualified, I qualified in 2007, and I actually came into radiotherapy during the third year of my psychology degree. So yes, I came to radiotherapy from perhaps a bit of a different angle, but I just have always been really passionate about the job as soon as I kind of found that and found that path. And I've just been very, very happy to work as a therapeutic radiographer.
The question we always ask is, how did you find out about therapeutic radiography? Because it's very niche, and a lot of people find out by accident.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was in the third year of my psychology degree, and sadly I lost my aunt at that period to cancer. And I think perhaps a lot of people that come into radiotherapy, it's because they have that personal experience of cancer, of perhaps losing someone close to them or being affected by cancer in some way that leads them to that area. And she was a nurse, so I kind of thought, actually, you know what, I want a job where I can look after people like she did, and I wanted to have a oncology focus so that in some small way I'm helping support patients with cancer. So as you do, you sort of research the different options, and I came across radiotherapy, and I just thought, that's it, that's the job for me. So I finished my psychology degree, but then I started my radiotherapy degree in the same year. So I think my parents would have quite liked me to, you know, get a job, but no, I started my degree straight away. I've been really lucky. When I qualified, I've worked in a variety of areas of practice, so pre-treatment. I worked in CyberKnife when we were lucky to have the first NHS CyberKnife unit. So that was a great experience. And then I spent a lot of years in brachytherapy, and I gained my advanced practitioner status in brachytherapy and IGRT. And I also did a master's in clinical oncology in that period as well. So I really enjoy studying at the same time. I've been very, very happy in clinical practice, but the opportunity to move into academia came up in 2016, and I thought, you know, I'll apply. I won't get an interview. But I was offered the job. I really didn't want to leave clinical practice. So I've kind of developed this, you know, been lucky to have been given the opportunity to have this sort of dual role where I now do 3 days a week in clinical practice and 2 days a week as a lecturer at university. And that also gave me the opportunity to do my master's in education. So, yeah, I think the last 17 years have really, really been quite a journey for me.
Do you just want to have loads of letters after your name?
I'm just a serial academic, yeah. No, I mean, I really love studying. I am just a real, geek for learning, really. And that's, you know, I can get interested in any topic area, really, in radiotherapy. So I was always told, you know, for advanced practice, you've got to really have a precise, you know, clear area of practice. But actually, my practice is brachytherapy, IGRT, and gynae. Specialism. So yeah, perhaps, you know, I never wanted to narrow myself to one area.
Well, so keeping up your clinical work, is that It's an interesting decision because lots of people I know give up their clinical work completely, or like me, don't want to give up clinical, so do 2 or 3 lectures a year virtually, just because I really enjoy it, but I don't want to be fully in academia. What made you want to do both?
Yes, I mean, I think initially, I never really thought I would get the role, and then once I was in it, it was quite a steep learning curve. So I think I wanted to always kind of keep a foot in both camps just to keep my options open. But actually, I really enjoy the challenge of having both roles. I feel like they complement each other so well. It is challenging. It is challenging. So, you know, you do have to be quite clear about your boundaries and when you're working in each role, and that can sometimes be quite difficult. But yeah, to be honest, I've never not wanted to be a therapeutic radiographer. For me, that's still where my passion lies, you know, in supporting patients. But it's really nice that I can also sort of fuel this other side of me, where I can be involved in academia, and I really love working with students as well. I love seeing that journey from when they come in to when they graduate, and I now work alongside a lot of graduates that I've sort of taught, which is lovely to see. It's really great to see them progress and to shine.
It's lovely to see them, but then you realise how you've been qualified when they're getting married, having babies, having another baby, then advancing in their career. It's very scary.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it is. It is very scary when you see, you sort of see, oh, now they're superintendents, or, you know, now they're doing doctorates, and you think, wow, that really is quite a journey.
So, Louise, the other letters coming after your name with the doctoral research, can you tell us a bit more about that and how you got involved in it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the full doctorate still feels a very, very long way off at the moment, so I'm not, you know, counting my chickens. But yeah, when I did the Masters in Education, I was really lucky to do a module on the philosophy of education and social justice. And sort of starting to learn about these issues really changed my whole perspective. And they talked about the awarding gap that's seen in higher education. And that is the difference that's seen in the percentage of 2-1 and first class degrees that are received by students from Black, Asian and ethnically diverse backgrounds in comparison to their white course mates. And this difference is currently approximately around 8.8%. So that's a UK average. But it's also seen in other Western higher education situations, so in Europe and America as well, this difference in awards is often seen. I mean, this gap has come down from 13% in 2017, which you could consider an improvement. But one of the issues with that is that, you know, that figure treats what are a very diverse group of students as one. So actually, when we examine that data, the gap can be very different for different student groups. So that awarding gap, as it's termed in higher education, is actually around 18% for students who come from Black backgrounds in comparison to white students. So whilst the picture does seem to be improving when we consider groups as a whole, actually there's still some very finite detail that really matters for particular ethnic groups. So, you know, when I learnt about this, I was frustrated. I was really quite taken aback. I found it quite difficult data to come to terms with. And I really wanted to sort of investigate more and to try in some way to sort of work in this area. And it also occurred to me that a lot of the data in this area is from purely academic degrees. And training for a healthcare degree, whether it's physiotherapy, midwifery, nursing, you know, you're working in these two environments. You've got to, you know, survive in the academic environment, and also you've got to develop and progress in on placement as well. So that was, you know, an area of difference for me, that I wasn't seeing our students sort of represented there. And I also sort of was thinking with my professional hat on, well, actually, if students aren't receiving these 2-1 degrees and first degrees, what does that mean for postgraduate study, advanced practice, consultant practice? You know, a lot of our frameworks now talk about these practices being supported by masters and by doctorates. So what's happening there? And also students leaving courses. If we're losing students from the course, they're not completing the degrees. That's a real loss of talent for the profession. My doctorate has really evolved to look at the overall experience of students, because there isn't data in that area. There isn't anything specific for radiotherapy. There is data in nursing, there is data in physiotherapy, there is some in diagnostic, but there's nothing specifically for radiotherapy students. So to look at those experiences and ultimately to try and develop some sort of framework or theory of how to support student success, really, so that we can reduce this gap that we see between student groups.
Can you talk to us a little bit, Louise, about your methodology? Because I just know from personal experience, when you're doing research in a field like this, actually getting participation can actually be a challenge. So it'd be great for you to just talk us through what you did and how you engaged with your participants.
Sure, absolutely. So it is a mixed method study. So there's three phases to the data collection, because like I say, there's not a lot really to sort of build your study on or to go from. So I started with a broad survey. If any students are listening who took part, thank you very much. Or if you've seen the post on social media, thank you to anyone who took part. But the survey was really just to try and get that whole picture. But as you say, it can be really difficult to reach out to people. I've also really had to consider my own position, my position of privilege. I am a white, cisgendered, woman in a position of power in some respect, being a lecturer and, being a senior radiographer. So I've had to really reflect on actually how that impacts and actually what's going to work best for the student and what's going to make them feel comfortable. So I recently ran focus groups, and I was lucky to have a facilitator work with me who was from an ethnically diverse background to try and help with that and to facilitate that discussion. And then the last stage will be interviews. So that will be the last part of my data collection. But it is really important for me to appreciate the context that I'm working in and to really sort of consider what's going to be best for the students that are taking part, rather than what I want as a researcher, because yes, I have to understand my whiteness and how that feeds into the context of what I'm trying to do.
Sorry to put you on the spot, but when you say that about your whiteness, how would you explain that to people who don't understand that and think they're not being racist or they're not understanding? Because there's a lot of people who think that way.
Yes, there is. And I have had people that have questioned me that have sort of said, well, how do you know the experience is different for students from ethnically diverse backgrounds? How do you know it's not just all students? Or even suggesting that I should have a group to compare the student experience to. And I think it is something that's difficult perhaps to come to terms with, but it's understanding that idea that you might not feel you're privileged, or you might not feel you've had particular advantages. But we don't live in a post-racial society. Racism still is very sadly with us. And I think if you come from a white background, it is sometimes difficult to appreciate what that means or how that might influence your interactions in education or in the workplace or, within healthcare, all these different ways in which racism and race can play into that. So I do appreciate that. And I say before I started doing this work, I was, I'll admit, I was quite naive to that idea of white privilege and what it meant. But I think it does obviously play a role, and it is something that is important to consider.
Louise, have you developed your knowledge and expertise around this area, like in terms of maybe what you anticipated the results to maybe produce from some of the data collection that you've already got. Had you already got a preconceived idea that maybe had changed or that did kind of meet your assumptions initially?
Yeah, I mean, I think because when you read quite a lot in the area to sort of prepare for this sort of work, there are a lot of common themes that come out. So a lot of themes around curriculum and about having diverse curriculums and about representation. So you kind of go into it with some of those existing themes from the literature. But a part of the doctoral research is that you keep a reflective journal and you keep notes of how your thought process is evolving, and when perhaps something comes up that you're not expecting, you know, you go to that and you try and question yourself and think about, actually, am I putting my own perspective onto this? Where might I be interpreting this? Whereas someone else with a different lived experience might see it differently. But yeah, it's very difficult not to kind of have that influence and that perception. But that is where it's really important as well to have involvement of students wherever possible. So for the survey, I worked with a group of students who kind of drove the questions really for that questionnaire. So yeah, again, I was very privileged to have their input to that, so that yes, there was evidence from the literature that informed it, but it also did have a lot of questions that they phrased that were included in the survey without any rewording. So to try and get that student voice, and yeah, it can't be me that kind of makes a lot of those decisions, because I don't have that lived experience. I can't fully appreciate what it's like. So yeah, I've had a group of students that I've worked with throughout the development of the doctorate as well to help with that.
How have they found the experience of working with this?
I mean, a lot of the feedback has been that they've enjoyed sort of getting that insight into research, and a number of them are qualified radiographers now as well, but they've still fed into the research, so it's nice that they've sort of continued that participation as well. And some people have fed back as well that actually talking about the issues and actually being able to talk with other students about it has been quite valuable as well. So there is that kind of sense of, you know, member checking, you know, sort of having that confirmation that actually you're not imagining these things that are happening, or you know, it's not something, you're not being overly sensitive, that it is something that other people are perhaps finding common ground with as well.
How do you see the kind of the outputs of it landing with our community in radiotherapy?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think for me, it's important that the results are put out there as they are, that it's, you know, what I'm finding is there are details of racism, there are details of microaggressions that are coming through in some of the research. And as we mentioned before about how people might perceive this idea of white privilege and talking about race can be very uncomfortable for people. But I think it's important as well that we don't see it as something to it's not necessarily a critique or something to feel guilt about. It's much more about how do we move things forward? How do we actually put things in place that are going to support students, that are going to improve equality of outcome, you know, in higher education, in healthcare settings, in the workplace. So for me, it's very much, yes, the data is going to be what it's going to be, but also it's about how we move forward and how we all work together to actually make these changes.
Has anything surprised you, Louise, in terms of kind of what maybe some of the outputs have been? And I know obviously with doctoral study, you can't necessarily give us all the results, but in terms of kind of maybe some of your reflections, is there anything that you have gone home and had to really process?
Yeah, I mean, I think there have been some surprising elements. And of course, when people are sharing things that have happened to them, it can be quite difficult as well. But I think there's, a lot of the data I'm still obviously working through it. And because each stage informs the next stage of the research and what questions are asked, then yeah, it's important to kind of look at what's coming out and again, not to try and put my own focus on it, but to really look at what's been said and pick out what's being said. But I'm still kind of working and processing through a lot of that.
Louise, as a consequence of doing your doctorate so far, has your view on what EDI means changed at all for you?
I think it deepens as you move through, because I think I'm appreciating increasingly how important it is. For me, there's kind of two perspectives. There's the social justice perspective, which is, yes, we should all live in a society and work in environments where equality is there and where diversity is welcomed and that everyone feels included. You know, that is the moral argument for EDI work. But I say I also have my professional hat on with this as well. And to me, it's just, the profession really needs this diversity. Like, what are we missing out on by not hearing these different viewpoints or not thinking about things in a different way? Our patients are so diverse. So if we want to better serve them, then we really need to welcome diversity. And particularly for me, I think when you think about the fact that the NHS, there are so many people working, just under a quarter of the workforce in the NHS come from ethnically diverse backgrounds, but only 10% of those are actually working in leadership positions or in senior roles where they can have that impact on service delivery. So, that again actually steers so much of how services are designed and about what comes through eventually to the patient. So that representation is so important as well at senior levels, because it's so difficult for students to be what they cannot see. For me, from a professional point of view, it's just, I worry about what we're missing out on and what patients are not getting if we're not sort of having full representation in the workforce.
The global majority isn't white either.
Yes, I mean, terminology is a whole nother phrase, isn't it? I mean, I like the term global majority, but I think the difficulty with it is it's not particularly well understood. But obviously BAME is not something we want to use anymore. That's not appropriate. But global majority would be my preferred term, because I think ethnic minority in some ways also continues to kind of almost reaffirm this position of being less than, or I know for data purposes it can be helpful when we're looking at UK-wide data to group people together, because otherwise you're not going to actually see the picture of what's happening. I think global majority would be a nice place to get to.
Louise, has your practice changed clinically as a consequence of doing your doctorate?
Yeah, I think certainly I've become much more mindful of my interactions, much more potentially aware of my own practice and my own terminology that I use, and just having that greater awareness. So I think that has certainly evolved. But like the work that you're both doing as well, in skincare effects and in raising the profile of some of these issues and talking about diverse groups of people, all of that I think is influencing the workforce and clinical practice as well. So that is really, really beneficial.
With the experiences that people have kind of shared with you, I'm just trying to remember back to when I was a student. I definitely faced racism, not from anyone at university or any of my student colleagues, but definitely professionals and patients as well where I worked. And then even in the past few jobs that I've been in, I've faced it from professionals and from patients again, but I've never really got that support from leadership anyway. I wonder if students that have shared experiences with you, if they've noticed the lack of support or anything like that as well.
Yeah, I think it's very, very difficult for students. The risk as someone from an ethnically diverse background of making, I don't want to say a claim, but, you know, making a statement about this is what's happened to me and I want someone to listen to me and to believe me, that, you know, there's a big risk for students in doing that, because they have to consider, as I say, whether they'll be believed or not. You know, will they be told, oh, it's a personality difference, or, you know, they don't mean to be like that? And then once they've, if they've had the courage to speak to someone, you know, then it's that worry for them of what's this going to mean for my future in this department, or what's it going to mean professionally if I end up working in this department, or, you know, it's all those worries. So, yeah, I think sort of being able to share that is something that certainly, you know, needs to be there for departments and needs to be there for universities, to have mechanisms for students to raise these issues and to have them taken seriously, and to, yeah, have those sort of things challenged, really, and to have that allyship that actually you will be believed, and we do understand that, you know, your experience may be different to what someone else experiences.
I think the two key points you mentioned is kind of gaslighting and privilege again. People in privileged positions, and then, as I've faced many, many a time, gaslighting, oh, it's not how I meant it, oh, you've misheard me. No, I know what you said. If anyone's faced racism or discrimination, you never bloody forget what they say. There's absolutely no, like, it's just, it doesn't happen.
No, absolutely. And it's even things like, you know, just how someone looks at you, or how someone interacts with you after that point, or, you know, people have shared microaggressions in terms of commenting on accents, commenting on, you know, use of English, commenting on hairstyles. It's all those things that perhaps to someone from who's not from an ethnically diverse background perhaps wouldn't see the connection or wouldn't see the impact. But for a lot of students, it's you know, it's that small sort of build up of these effects happening day after day. And it's not just in the hospital environment, it's, you know, it's when you're outside the hospital, and potentially, you know, it could be happening at university as well. So it's all those things. That's what I'd love to answer, is, you know, what's happening that is then impacting on how students are succeeding at university. But yeah, that's going to take some time, and obviously a lot of analysis on my part, and it is a collective effort as well. You know, we're all responsible for students. These are our future colleagues. You know, we want them to be great. We want them to progress and have every success that they can. But they only do that through our support. And say part of that is about, you know, building this allyship and having that understanding of actually what could be happening for these students.
For any students listening, Louise, what advice and support would you give them if they have found themselves in this situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very easy for me to say speak up and tell someone, because I do recognise it is a risk. It is a risk for students to voice what's happening to them. But if there is someone that you trust, if there is someone that, even if you don't want action to be taken, but you just want to share what's happening to you, then, you know, if you feel comfortable to do that, then do that. I know certainly for University of Hertfordshire, we do have mechanisms for reporting discrimination that can be done centrally through the university. So, you know, many universities will have these mechanisms where you can actually report it, or you can get support outside of your programme. Because you may not want to talk about it with lecturers, you might not want to talk about it with your clinical learning facilitators, or, you know, radiographers that you work with. But yeah, so I think if you feel able to, then yes, it's great if we can kind of be more open about these discussions, and that we can actually have these discussions with people who are involved as well. And just sometimes it's not about calling out someone. It may be about calling that person in and just actually saying, you know, I noticed you said that, or you said that about that student. Do you think, you know, are you thinking about that from a certain perspective, or what do you mean by that? So we're kind of all responsible for that really.
I think it's right that you said about being everyone's responsibility, because, you know, as we all know, students are the future workforce. If you bully them now and put them in a hole, they're going to struggle when they come into work. And they might not even make it to being a fully fledged professional or leave early. I've supported young students, first years, second years, third years, whatever, who've had or faced discrimination. And I've watched it happen. And as you said, you can call people out politely. But I think the responsibility also falls on us as professionals. If you see it, you do need to do something about it. Because firstly, discrimination is illegal. That's something I found out through a recent process of facing discrimination and bullying. It is illegal. It's not allowed to happen. And if it does happen, people can lose their jobs over it. There have been tribunals recently all over the NHS that's happened, like the Michelle Cox case and stuff like that. But it's a really good point that it is actually the professional responsibility as well. If you know someone has a certain mindset or, you know, that's how they've always been, that's not the point how they've always been. It's time to educate them to stop it happening again, because it will impact patients.
Yeah, absolutely. It's time, you know, we have to draw a line under it. You know, students need to be having valuable learning in the clinical environment, and they can't do that if they're worried about their interactions or they're feeling on edge. And yeah, absolutely. It doesn't matter what position you're in, what seniority you have. If you see something or you hear something that doesn't feel right, or you notice, okay, that student really, that's really unpleasant for that student, you know, as much as possible, deal with it there and then, and you know, speak to that person. But yeah, like you said, there are mechanisms that if you need to, then to report things and have action taken, really. Because yeah, I think change really needs to happen in this environment, in the clinical practice environment.
Louise, I'm going to ask you a controversial question. I told you there was going to be one. From your doctorate, you're obviously finding out maybe very in-depth details about students' experiences. From an ethical perspective, are you able to start to implement changes within your university and share what you're learning so that changes are being made? Or is it part of that doctoral process that you have to get to the end to then initiate change? I'm just thinking, if you know already that there are processes that need to change because of the experiences that students are having, can you do it now? Or does that jeopardise your doctorate?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, there is an element that you have to see the whole picture, and it is a process. But yeah, I agree with you that there are certain themes that are coming out around representation, around support, that are things that we can start to put in practice on a programme level. I also feed into a working group in the university as well that are looking at the whole university and the sort of action plans around that, because it is something that universities are aware of, and they are actually putting a lot of funding and work into addressing the awarding gap. So it is a focus for higher education. But yeah, I think possibly for radiotherapy specific, because I think it will be quite specific to the clinical environment, perhaps do need to see the overall picture. But certainly things that say around support, around having you know, someone who will support you and can offer you that, and just, you know, in the clinical environment, just having someone that's willing to teach you and willing to work with you and see you as the whole person, really. You know, we all bring different parts of ourselves into the workplace, and it's no different for students. So I think just having that compassion and that consideration for what someone might be going through. So these are all things that we can start to implement ourselves. But yes, I'm hoping to have some more kind of concrete and sort of tangible sort of theories and recommendations at the end of the doctorate.
When do you think we might start to see some snippets of it before then?
So there will be some, there are some posters coming up at a couple of the conferences this year, so that at ISTRO and also at UKIO. So the last few weeks have been quite an intense period of data collection. So towards the end of the year, I'll be hoping to sort of get something published around that. But yeah, there is some early data coming out in the next couple of months that I'll be able to share.
So, Louise, we're coming to the end of the podcast. You've given us some top tips already, but we do like to always end the podcast with kind of some lasting impressions, and also obviously some maybe tips for people who are listening. So is there anything that you'd like to kind of share at the end?
I'll kind of stick with the student focus, I guess, but just to say that, you know, therapeutic radiography is such a fantastic job. It's really a privileged position to be able to support people through what is probably the most difficult time in their life. And diversity is needed. That is needed in the profession if we want to achieve that support for patients. But I would say to students who are training now and who are perhaps graduating this year that it's never too early to start building your network of people who can support you. And there are so many roles, or, you know, in my case, combinations of roles that you can sort of build together into this portfolio career. And really, you know, for such a niche role in some ways, there's so much you can do. And you can be the architect of your own future and build this career that's going to be purposeful and fulfilling for you.
That was brilliant.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you all for listening to Rad Chat. Your hosts today have been myself, Jo McNamara, and Namanjoka Anderson. If you're utilising this podcast for CPD purposes, consider the reflective questions posted along with links to resources and literature that we've discussed. To receive your accredited CPD certificate, please complete the form linked with the podcast. Our next guest to feature will be Cheryl Johnson and Sarah Davis, who will be discussing sex and intimacy for people living with and beyond cancer. Thank you all for listening, and take care.